The osprey hailed by Roger Torrey Peterson as the symbol of the New England coast all but vanished during the 50s and 60s because of the ravages of DDT. In the next few decades, however, the birds return, slowly at first, and then in a rush. Now, writing with passion, humor, and reverence for the natural world, David Gessner interweaves the stories of the nesting osprey pairs he observed with his own readjustment to life on the wind-blown, beautiful, and increasingly developed landscape that he knew as a child. The book is A Season of Flight and Wonder. The name of the book is Return of the Osprey, A Season of Flight and Wonder. The book is 25 years old and has a very special 25th anniversary edition out, and it's a great pleasure to welcome David Gessner to the roundtable this morning. David, thank you very much for being with us.
Thanks, Joe. I really appreciate it.
It's really nice to have you on the program. Where were you in the story of this and your following of it when you wrote the book 25 years ago?
I had moved back to Cape Cod. When I was 30 years old, I found out I had testicular cancer and a relatively mild case of cancer, but was irradiated. And I was living in Worcester, Mass., which is my old hometown. That's kind of my dark secret as a nature writer. I'm originally from Worcester. And after that, I found out while I was going through radiation that I'd gotten into the University of Colorado, Wilmington. And I moved out there the next fall, spent 6 years there, met my wife there. While I was in Boulder, I wrote a book about loving Cape Cod and moved back to Cape Cod. I immediately wrote a book about loving Colorado while on Cape Cod, so I was very geographically confused. When I wrote those, the critics kept calling me a nature writer, and I was a little irritated by that. I thought I'd written about life and death and not just about nature, but one of my reactions to that was to write a piece called Sick of Nature, and it was my declaration of independence from the genre. And the irony was that an editor for Algonquin Press read it and asked me to do a nature book and said, you write beautifully about birds. So I finally kind of accepted the fact I was a nature writer, and I thought about what birds I'd want to write about. And I had never seen ospreys during summers on Cape Cod when I was young. And now they were back, and I was back on Cape Cod too. So I said, I'll write a book about ospreys. And then she did something kind of miraculous. She gave me my first advance. It wasn't very much, but it was enough to quit my job and buy a telescope. And I went out on the marshes and I watched four nests for the next 6 months, starting in March. And it was transformative, really. It changed my life. And it was a new way of writing for me, too. And I fell hard for ospreys during that time.
So you immerse yourself for an entire nesting season in the lives of these osprey. And I'm fascinated because it seems like you have to assume going in to want to do it that there's going to be something interesting and exciting that is going to happen over that several-month journey.
Yeah, and I went down and met with Alan Poole in Westport, Massachusetts. Alan was kind of my Obi-Wan Kenobi for the trip, and he said, you have to learn to live on osprey time. And I'm pretty easily bored, so my first attempts were failures, for sure. I'd sit there, and I'd say, I'm going to stay here for a few hours, and I'd stare at the marsh and the birds who were just starting to rebuild their nests, and I felt I was there for a long time, and I'd look down at my watch, and 7 minutes had passed. So it took me a while to kind of slow down. One of the things I did is I had a big journal with me, and I'd scribble down everything I saw. So at the beginning, it's cold and windy and it's March, and you'd see them just starting to rebuild these big shaggy nests, which most people know are like on top of human platforms. So they're half human, half avian construction. And these nests, the male would go bring a stick back, and the female, who is the main nest builder, would say, not that one, you idiot, and send them back. And they gradually started to build them up. And one of the things I loved right away is they're kind of slobs. You know, they're not neatniks for sure. And there'd be boat line in there and Easter tinsel once April came along. And in one of the nests I watched, there was a naked Barbie doll, which I just learned, I did another kind of osprey tour of the East Coast, is not unique. Someone else had a Barbie doll in their nest. So, you know, it took a little while to slow myself down and do it, but it was amazing. You know, gradually they start nesting and the male, you know, is bringing back fish and the female is hunkering down. And gradually, you know, those eggs crack open and little reptilian heads come out and gradually they start to fly. So it was really kind of getting myself in sync with the year.
David Gessner is our guest. The name of the book is Return of the Osprey, A Season of Flight and Wonder. You have a chapter in the book, Fishing, and I'd just like to read a portion of that. Ospreys are the only raptors that dive fully into the waters to catch their prey. Try to imagine the physical sensation to skim across the sky above the ocean, peering down with eyes that can see into the shallows from 40, 60, even 100 feet up, to catch a glint or the shadow of a movement and know it to be a fish. The one thing that keeps you alive. To hover, adjust, beating your wings so that you stay in place like a giant kingfisher or hummingbird. Then to dive, to commit, to tuck with folded wings and plunge downward at over 40 miles an hour while still keeping your eyes on the prey, calculating its size and movement. To adjust in midair, redirecting, considering even the refraction of the fish's image in the water before pulling in your wings and diving again. And then, at the last second before hitting the water, to throw your wings back and your talons forward, striking feet first, to plunge in, splash, immerse, and make contact at the same time, trapping, piercing, clutching a slippery, scaled, cold-blooded creature. Man, you can write. That is beautiful.
Well, thank you. You didn't include what comes a little later, though, which is the punchline. So far, I've only seen a dive in my imagination. I mean, a lot of these books are written by experts, and I was anything but when I started. I was a bumbler, you know. And so I couldn't tell a gull from an osprey at first. So the book is really kind of got a plot to it, which is my deepening interest. And soon I saw my first dive, which I dance around and celebrate. In the years since, I've seen hundreds of dives in Cuba and Venezuela and on the East Coast and on Cape Cod. But that was kind of the beginning for me. Just what you just read was thrilling to see my first dives.
But in what I just read, you can feel your excitement and command an interest in the overall subject.
Yeah, I mean, it's interesting. You know, before that, I hadn't, you know, of course I'd done research for books, but I hadn't, you said, immersed myself as much. And one of the interesting things from a writing point of view is I knew I couldn't really begin the book until the ospreys left in September. And that enforced patience. Like I said, I'm not naturally a patient person, but I was taking notes and I felt it building and building in me. So eventually when I wrote the book, including those lines, I did it in about a month, the draft, because it kind of burst out of me at that point. So it was pretty intense. And the other thing that I found going on, you know, I've always loved that John Muir line about when you pick up one thing in the universe, you find it hitched to everything else. And it really was true, because by day I was watching ospreys and at night I was reading ospreys. And I learned a lot of the different stories, including, of course, the DDT story, the way they were connected to that.
A technical question about the writing, but in let's use what I read as an example, or maybe another section of the book, where you so beautifully explain something. Is that written in the moment, or is that something that you reflect on and write later?
I had a big old journal with me, and often I would get something rough down in the moment. But then it would kind of, you know, stew and grow in me. And generally, you know, I'm a voice-driven writer. I try to recapture my voice. And then it would, when I did it, it would be later, and it would generally come out almost whole when I first did it, because I'd been thinking about it so much.
I mentioned that this is the 25th anniversary of Return of the Osprey. And one of the things in writing, you were celebrating the return of the Osprey, hence the title. But the Osprey is once again having trouble and is threatened as we look at
exactly.
it right now.
Exactly. And this was not in any way planned, but 3 weeks before the book came out, October 15th, I took a trip up the East Coast. And, you know, and learned just what you said, how threatened it is right now for a totally different reason, this time for industrial overfishing, specifically in Virginia, which has consequences for Maryland, Delaware, and southern New Jersey as well. And ospreys are starving. They're starving because menhaden, the fish they rely on, is being industrially fished still in the Chesapeake Bay waters. These numbers are actually starting to be reflected further north as well. Menhaden is this energy-rich fish that's, you know, one of them is worth three of another fish because it's this kind of power bar of energy. And we're still taking them, millions of tons of them, to be ground up to become, ironically, fish meal for salmon farms, which then become part of our food chain as we eat salmon, but also for dog food and fertilizer. So this is, you know, this is the new DDT, basically. I will say that one of the amazing things about the Osprey is they were there for basically the beginning of environmental law, because the group on Long Island, that was a community group that would gradually become the Environmental Defense Fund, saw what DDT was doing on the waters and to the fish that osprey were eating. And then what happened was when the DDT got in their system, the eggs that ospreys laid were thin and they would unintentionally crush them on the nest. So as you said earlier, the numbers plummeted. We were down to, you know, just, you know, 10 pair in Massachusetts and by outlawing DDT, it was amazing. We did something by restraining ourselves that led to this comeback. And now we're faced with that crisis again.
How would, do you believe, the book be different if you were to write it today as to what you could witness in immersing yourself into that nesting season?
Well, for one thing, even though there's this new threat, you know, on Cape Cod, the numbers are, you know, still remain much greater than when I did it. And, you know, it would still have been, had I written it a year ago, a hopeful story. But now it's a newly threatened story. In that, it's similar to other stories. I also write in other books about public lands in the West, which are newly threatened. I've written a lot about southern Louisiana, where the diversion of the Mississippi was hopefully going to, they were going to use billions of dollars of BP money from the settlement to divert the Mississippi and rebuild land. But now that's been shot down by the Republican governor there. So these hopeful environmental stories that I got to say I've really relied on over the last 25 years are now taking a darker twist, which is tough. The one hopeful thing I will say is the alliance, the old alliance between conservatives in this sense, like old school conservatives, hunters and fishermen, and environmentalists, is still a hopeful thing. I mean, it's why the public lands seizures got taken out of the big, beautiful bill. And here, in this case, on the East Coast with ospreys, it's hopeful in that fishermen, you know, and watermen are really allying themselves with osprey lovers and environmentalists, because menhaden are a building block for stripers and bluefish and other fish that, you know, they're sport fishing. So there is an alliance there that hopefully will hold and maybe can stop the industrial fishing of menhaden.
David Gessner is our guest. The book, Return of the Osprey, A Season of Flight and Wonder. And we're celebrating the 25th anniversary of the book. There is a chapter in the book called Respecting Our Elders. Could you talk about the context of that?
Well, I mentioned to you before we got on that I've just spent the last week working in the studio of John Hay, who is a great nature writer who moved to Cape Cod in the late 40s, 50s, after World War II, where he served. And he had bought what the realtor called a worthless woodlot of 100 acres for $15 an acre. It might have been 25. I don't know. I wrote the book a while ago, but it wasn't much. And he kind of planted his flag there on top of what's called Dry Hill, not too far from where I'm talking right now. And he started to explore the natural world. And at first, like me, he was a beginner. He heard a mourning dove and thought it was an owl. But over the next 50 years, he followed herring and he followed the fish that return upstream, go from saltwater to freshwater, and terns, and it opened up the world to him. And John Hay came from kind of an aristocratic background. His grandfather was Teddy Roosevelt's Secretary of State, and he had been there with Lincoln when he died. But this John Hay said later on, how strange to go through the whole 20th century and find what's most interesting are the birds. Or maybe it's just that the human mind is more interesting when it's looking outside beyond itself. So John was one of those elders, and ospreys were elders too, in a way. They'd been doing this for thousands of years. So it was kind of a return to something more traditional, you know. On the other hand, I took it in my own direction. I got pretty obsessed with ospreys. I remember coming back from the nest and running into somebody who looked at me, and they were all excited. They'd just seen the birds flying around. And I thought, have you found ospreys too? And then later, my wife saw me. I'd gone up to the fish market and gotten the fish and was on the back deck in my bathing suit. I guess it looked a little like a loincloth, and I was pulling it apart with pliers to get the feeling of like what it's like was like for an osprey. Because one of my favorite amazing sights during the year was watching usually the female tear savagely the fish apart and then oh so delicately put it in the nestling's mouths. And it was like this marriage of the savage and the delicate that I thought was amazing.
Helen McDonald, in her introduction to this edition of your book, says that it's a story of a man who taught himself to see, taught himself to know, discovering all kinds of things about himself and the wider ways that humans relate to wildness and the world around us. Could you touch on your thoughts on what we can do better to teach ourselves to see and to know, especially when it comes to the natural world?
I think, first of all, I'm deeply appreciative of Helen's words. They were very generous. But for me, it was a change. You know, as a writer, it was a change because I'd grown up kind of weaned on Philip Roth and Kurt Vonnegut, and with a little throw splashed in there. But it was the first time that I really turned outward. Now, it was ironic in a way because it also helped me looking inward, you know, to see a world beyond myself, as I mentioned that John Hay said, where it shook me up a little bit. And I saw that, you know, kind of my personal salvation wasn't just about psychoanalyzing, you know, myself. It was about looking at the world. And I accepted that I was not an expert, you know, that I started to notice what I wrote in that journal was about the trees, was about phenology, watching the year go round. Like right now, I'm up on Cape Cod and watching my favorite week of the year, the last week of October, as you know, as the change occurs, as the cord grass on the beach turns blazing orange, and you know, and following that year, like when I lived there that year, I remember at one point walking the beach and thinking to myself, the seals should be back soon. And what I meant, and I told my wife that, you know, the seals should be back soon, was they'd come back from Maine for the winter and be on our rocks. And 2 days later, they were back, and I jumped around like I'd gotten a promotion at work. I felt like I was in sync with the year in a different way. And I think a lot of people do that. Weirdly, for instance, the Cornell app, you know, on the phone has more people listening to birds and being able to identify birds they don't see. So I do think that kind of nudging ourselves out of ourselves is one of the lessons I took from the year, and something that I don't always succeed, but I continue to try to do.
The name of the book, Return of the Osprey, A Season of Flight and Wonder, celebrating its 25th anniversary edition. It is published by Cornell University Press. David Gassner, a great pleasure to have you on the program. I thank you so much for sharing with us and for the beautiful words and the beautiful book you have produced. I appreciate it.
And I thank you for reading the book so carefully. It was apparent from your questions, so I really appreciate that.
Thank you very much. I appreciate it. Again, the name of the book, Return of the Osprey, a 25th anniversary edition published by Cornell University Press. You're listening to The Roundtable on WAMC.